Good afternoon, and welcome to the What's Next series, Affirmative Action in the Wake of Fisher conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number 1 on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. Thank you. Mr. Alexian, you may begin your conference.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Nicholas Alexiou. I'm the Assistant Director of Lawyer Chapters here at the American Constitution Society. We're so pleased that you've joined us for our third installment of our What's Next series, What's Next, the Affirmative Action in the Wake of Fisher. We're very excited to have with us Jean Nichol today. Jean is the Boyd Tinsley Distinguished Professor of Law and Director of the Center on Poverty, Work, and Opportunity at the University of North Carolina Law School, where he teaches constitutional law and federal courts. Jean also provides a unique perspective in that he has a lot of higher education experience in terms of the administrative staff. So Jean was the dean of UNC School of Law from 1999 to 2005. He was also the 26th president of the College of William & Mary and has also served as the dean of the University of Colorado. He also founded the Byron White Center for Constitutional Law at the University of Colorado and the Center for Civil Rights at the University of North Carolina. So Jean will be able to provide us with both a constitutional law perspective and a more practical perspective on affirmative action in higher education in the wake of Fisher. So Jean, take it away.
Thanks a lot, Nick. And it might be true that I can offer these varied perspectives, having been a dean and a president for at least a while, but it's also true that, as everyone on the call knows, that deans and presidents don't really have a very strong grasp of what they're talking about. So I wouldn't expect a great deal on that front. I do want to add my welcome to everybody and maybe give a modest cheer for the American Constitution Society and all its great work, maybe this program accepted. It's my assignment to talk about racial affirmative action in higher education admissions, more pointedly, and I think almost exclusively about the case of Abigail Fisher against what happens to be my alma mater, the University of Texas, as you all know, which was decided by the Supreme Court on June 24th as the close of term neared. Beyond the usual hazards one might have in talking about a new decision, for my part, I could add the obvious concern that almost everybody knows a great deal about the Fisher case. And second, there's a pretty broad consensus, even after the long wait, that the court didn't say as much as people thought it would, for good or ill, or some people think it didn't say much of importance at all. So both those realities make my task maybe a little tougher. But thinking as we begin, thinking, of course, as the Lone Star State, as this case reminds, it occurred to me to recall that if George W. Bush taught us anything, it's the value of low expectations. So with that, I will get started. Fisher, and here, given what I've said, I'll be brief, sort of summarizing the ruling. But Ms. Fisher, who was white, challenged the University of Texas admissions program, claiming she was denied admission to the undergraduate class in Austin because of her race. Texas won at the trial court level based on a purported application of Grutter. The Fifth Circuit, in an opinion by Judge Higginbottom, affirmed the district court's grant of summary judgment for the university. And the Supreme Court, as I think you all know, by a surprising 7-1 majority in a lead opinion, of course, written by Anthony Kennedy, held that the Fifth Circuit had failed to apply sufficiently rigorous scrutiny in the decision below, demanding, maybe it's fair to say, the strictest equal protection scrutiny rather than the Justice O'Connor-initiated, somewhat deference-laden, strict scrutiny of Grutter. And so the decision was vacated and remanded for further proceedings. Now, to fill that out just a little, Justice Kennedy, as I said, surprisingly joined not only by Justices Alito, Roberts, Scalia, and Thomas, but Justices Breyer and Sotomayor as well, with only Justice Ginsburg dissenting, as Justice Kagan had recused herself. Kennedy traced Texas's interesting admissions program history, moving from a personal achievement index methodology, which had been developed after the Fifth Circuit's Hopwood ruling in 1996, had outlawed the use of race as a factor in decision making. Then famously, the state legislature introduced its top 10% law, granting automatic admission to any public state college, including UT, to all students in the top 10% at Texas high schools meeting various standards. After Grutter was handed down a decade ago now, in 2003, the University of Texas decided it could do more to diversify its class. So it reintroduced race as a plus factor, seeking overtly to follow Grutter's guidance in what was thought to be a holistic process. But looking particularly at small classes between 5 and 24 students and developing an aggressive concept of the critical mass notion, okayed in the Michigan case. Of course, and then layering that over the statutorily demanded 10% rule, which due in part to Texas's frequently segregated high schools, had already produced a more diverse student body than its predecessor. Under this regime, Ms. Fisher was denied admission in 2008, and she sued. She subsequently attended LSU and graduated. As a Texan, I could say I suppose that being forced to go to LSU instead of Austin was thought to impose a particular and deep and pointed wound on the plaintiff that I can perhaps comprehend, even if I disagree with her position in the lawsuit. On the good news front, Justice Kennedy again embraced, without apology, Justice Powell's earlier assertion in Bakke that the pursuit of a diverse student body for a public university is a compelling state interest. Kennedy wrote, and I quote, "In Gratz and Grutter, the court endorsed precepts stated by Justice Powell, reaffirming his conclusion that obtaining the educational benefits of a diverse student body is a compelling state interest that can justify the use of race in university admissions." Now, admittedly, Justice Kennedy once again began his opinion, like he had done in some of the abortion cases, with the odd feint that, quote, "We take Bakke, Gratz, and Grutter as given for purposes of deciding the case." So Justices Scalia and Thomas and Roberts and Alito can subsequently muffle their embrace of the holding when their perceptions of future duty calls. And it was repeatedly noted in the opinion and the concurrences that Ms. Fisher had not asked that Grutter be overruled, as if that would somehow have bound enthusiastic justices. Still, it seems to me it can't have caused anything but a pointed heartburn in the Roberts, Alito, Scalia, and Thomas quarters to see sentences embracing the compelling nature of diversity as a state interest appear in an opinion to which their names were attached. And whatever else, the idea that the search for diversity in the student cohort is a compelling state interest, the idea on which all university affirmative action programs literally depend, it seems to me is substantially more secure today than it was 3 weeks ago. And given the Roberts opinion and parents involved, that's saying something, I think something significant. Then on the testy side, Justice Kennedy wrote that Grutter's conclusion that a university, quote, "educational judgment that diversity is essential to an educational mission is one to which we defer," is more limited than the Fifth Circuit had assumed. Kennedy wrote that there must be further judicial determination that the admissions process meets strict scrutiny in its implementation. Quote, "The means chosen must be narrowly tailored, and on this point, the university receives no deference whatsoever. It must therefore be, quote, necessary for a university to use race to achieve diversity. The reviewing court must ultimately be satisfied that no workable race-based alternative would produce the educational benefits of diversity that were sought. The Fifth Circuit, instead, he ruled, and what may have been at least a little unkind to the Fifth Circuit, had asked only whether, quote, the university's decision to reintroduce race was made in good faith. Most telling, Kennedy concluded, the higher education dynamic does not change the narrow tailoring analysis of strict scrutiny applicable in other contexts. Accordingly, the district court and the Court of Appeals had confined strict review too narrowly, so the decision below was vacated, though fairness to the litigants was said to require that the case be remanded to be judged under the appropriate standard. And there it shall go, perhaps to the satisfaction of no one. I'll make maybe a half dozen or so points about Fisher before opening up the floor. First, Fisher, it seems to me, falls prey without much discussion to the oddities of most of the court's other affirmative action decisions. Just quickly to illustrate, Abigail Fisher had notable standing and justiciability problems, which the justices once again principally chose to ignore. There was no chance that she'd now enroll in the University of Texas undergraduate program if she won. She admitted as much. It looked like any damage claim she might have would be limited to her admissions deposit, for which it's unclear, I would think, there would be any 1983 liability or that the 11th Amendment wouldn't intervene. The court overlooked those niceties in the apparent belief that those challenging affirmative action programs, once again, don't actually have to demonstrate concrete redressability, unlike other Article III plaintiffs. That's what I've come to think. I used to do a lot of standing work, and it's what I've come to think of as the special preference for litigants to challenge special preferences. And if standing isn't required for affirmative action challenges, neither for originalists, it seems, is originalism required. Justices Scalia and Thomas are more than adamant that the use of race in affirmative action is, in effect, per se, unconstitutional. For state institutions, that can be hard to square with the seeming intentions of the framers of the 14th Amendment. So in that instance, the theory of originalism is to be submerged or ignored. For affirmative action by the federal government in cases like Adirondack, the notion that the text and history outlaw the practice of affirmative action is preposterous. So for the day, again, originalism departs away like chastity. And once again, the backdrop of racial neutrality that the court assumes to be the constitutional set point against which to measure worrisome affirmative action departures is itself riddled with bias. As Justice Ginsburg mocked in her dissent, the notion that the Texas 10% rule is race neutral, born as it was in racial remedy and effective as it is, mainly as a result of segregated public schools, requires a legal mind, in quotes, in the sense that Thomas Reed Powell joked about the term. And more broadly, kind of moving the other direction, Texas and Michigan and Virginia and Carolina, where I work, and other publics constantly deploy legacy preferences, which apparently, according to the research of the last 5 years, have a larger impact on the admissions process than racial affirmative action. It's just an impact that massively favors white, wealthy applicants, one supposes the natural order of things, a practice that, unlike affirmative action, cannot possibly be squared with constitutional principle. What legitimate, equality-based admissions process can begin with the question, who's your daddy? But Fisher, if it has these shortcomings, it has them in common with almost all the affirmative action rulings. Next, I'd say a word about the lineup and perhaps the unfolding strategy. Most, including me, or maybe especially me, were surprised at the 7-1 arrangement. As I've indicated, on the one hand, Justices Alito and Roberts signed on to the Kennedy opinion. Now, I admit it has the waffle room of assumptions and concessions, but unlike Justices Scalia and Thomas, they didn't even write separately, though it is difficult to believe they actually accept on their own the notion of diversity in the student body as a compelling interest. As surprising for me, Justices Breyer and Sotomayor signed on readily, despite the much elevated scrutiny that Kennedy demands. That seems to me a change for Justice Breyer, who you might recall in Parents Involved, wrote that, quote, a contextual approach to scrutiny is altogether fitting in affirmative action cases, which is not strict in the traditional sense of that word. It's more guesswork, I would think, for Justice Sotomayor, but I wouldn't have guessed this result. So maybe this does represent some kind of grand bargain or modest grand bargain, a compromise in the old-fashioned sense in which some folks actually move from earlier positions in order to gain more companionship. I'd be the last to know about that, but I guess it is possible. Then following up, there's the perennial central question of American constitutional law, at least modern American constitutional law. What does Anthony Kennedy really want? Is his goal, Justice Kennedy's, in Fisher, to save affirmative action, but just to make it tighter, more restrictive, more rigorously grounded, less overarching, less presumptively permissible, less sloppy? Or, remembering that despite his kind words for diversity, he seems never to have met an affirmative action program he was actually willing to stomach in operation. Is he out to save but restrict affirmative action? Or is he really out to do in affirmative action without taking the political heat that might occur from announcing that you're doing so? I don't know what the answer to that is, though I lean more frequently to the latter assumption. Even with the DOMA case, I'm unable to join any lionized Kennedy movement. I remind you only of Citizens United, Heller, Carhart, Sebelius, Shelby County, and Bush against Gore, to limit myself to a half dozen. What it does seem fair to me to say is that Justice Kennedy is remarkably aggressive in his idiosyncrasy. Whatever it is that he thinks, he has no trouble forcing it on the rest of us. Finally, because I think I'll basically stop with this, except perhaps adding a word and only a word about the upcoming Michigan case, what about the impact of Fisher? Unlike what I've read in some quarters, I think it's large. It's mixed, I'd concede. It's mixed, but still large. The first reason for that, I've already suggested. I know it's possible, but it seems to me that despite the various proffered assumptions and concessions, Fisher does make it hard, at least for the next half dozen years or so, to hand down a new decision rejecting diversity of the student body as a compelling state interest. That fact alone is not to be undervalued. This diversity rationale, even if it's odd, is the only pillar on which to build an affirmative action program or anything like the foreseeable future, or perhaps ever, so I'm heartened by that. But I also think, on the other hand, that the shift from Justice O'Connor's affirmative action framework in Grutter to Kennedy's in Fisher is maybe greater than some have claimed, which is to say, I've always thought, as some of the critics have argued, that Grutter didn't actually demand any comprehensible notion of strict scrutiny. The embrace of deference to institutions of higher education, the leniency with which the critical mass notion was received and reviewed, the accepted or assumed equivalent treatment of various racial categories, the eased application of notions of necessity, those have always indicated to me some more congenial intermediate formula of review. I wouldn't have said what it was, but I wouldn't have called it strict scrutiny. Justice Kennedy, obviously, and I think overtly, means to rejoin the strict scrutiny of the racial higher education affirmative action cases to the strict scrutiny of the racial set-aside cases and more broadly to what he at least sees as the rest of the jurisprudence of the Equal Protection Clause. This inevitably, even with the retention of diversity, moves the calculus a good deal closer to the strict in theory but fatal in fact shorthand, thus Kennedy's concluding statement that strict scrutiny must not be strict in theory but feeble in fact. Maybe another way of saying that is this. We now have a settled, stated formula for deciding university affirmative action cases. Strict scrutiny, diversity as a compelling interest, the demand of necessary skepticism and necessary narrow tailoring and the like. What we don't have, in my view, is any Supreme Court opinion that has ever applied such a standard and upheld the program in question. Bakke didn't do what Fisher requires. Grutter didn't do it. Maybe Gratz did, but it invalidated the program. So I don't think anyone can say with a great deal of confidence what sort of existing, complex, multifaceted, but necessarily bureaucratically implemented affirmative action program would next week pass constitutional muster in the federal courts, either at the Supreme Court level or any of its inferiors. And for me, who has spent many years, sadly, working with university general counsels, I'm even married to one, it is their job to be cautious in the face of liability. Now, I know that the power of a university's commitment to affirmative action, the demand by the university and its faculty and its student body to be actually effectively integrated, isn't just a legal question. And the cautions of university lawyers are not going to provide the conclusive answer to a university's response. That decision is thought to be too central to the character and mission of the institution, and I am glad that that's so. But a candid general counsel will now say to an attentive president or chancellor that if we are sued, the chances that we'll be able to successfully defend our ambitious affirmative action program after Fisher are much diminished, or maybe much, much diminished today compared to 2 months ago. And for my money, that's bad news for American higher education. And I have little doubt, I may be wrong in this, but I have little doubt that that will be the result on at least an array of fronts on campuses across the country. Finally, and last, I've considered Chouette, I think that's the way you pronounce it, against the Coalition to Defend Affirmative Action, but, you know, the case involving Michigan's voter-approved ballot measure that ordered state government to stop using race as a factor in admissions to public colleges and universities, which the court accepted for review next term. I've considered that to be beyond the scope here, thankfully. Whatever else, the claim that Michigan has unconstitutionally altered the decision-making framework for racial minorities and perhaps women through the use of this amendment, it's a markedly different question than that posed by Fisher. And that means it's different than the question faced by the great majority of universities across the United States. So it's possible to have some hope that the very strongly split circuit court decision in validating the measure will be upheld. But I'm enough of a student of political rhetoric to think that the closer and closer the United States Supreme Court comes to saying that the Constitution forbids affirmative action, and it does move closer to that result in real implemented terms in Fisher, the less likely it may be that the same court would conclude, under whatever theory you have, that it's unconstitutional for a state to prohibit affirmative action. So, Nick, I'll stop there and we can open it up for questions.
Thank you so much, Gene. And I'll get things started with a question of my own. You mentioned Fisher was one of the last cases this, rendered on June 24th, but it was argued back in October. And so we had an 8.5-month gap for a case that was 7-1 and 13 pages. So what do you think? Do you think there was a broader opinion that eventually lost a coalition? Or what do you think took so long to have this result come out?
Well, that's my guess, and I don't know the truth of it. I think that it's You know, you could also ask the question more broadly, given the way it came out, why was it picked up in the first place? If I was doing that kind of guesswork, which I'm not good at, I would think that maybe four members of the court thought that they were going to get a bigger result out of this, meaning they might have had a stronger chance of convincing Justice Kennedy to do Grutter in or to go further along that line. But I have no, you know, clue that that's actually so. But if that was true and they thought they were going to get more and they weren't able to pull that off, then you end up with this short, but I think, I mean, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I think pretty consequential ruling. But I'm guessing those four wouldn't have been tremendously happy with the single notion of having diversity as a compelling state interest kind of re-ratified. So it's, you know, it may well be true that everybody ended up somewhat disappointed in the outcome and the description of this case, except Justice Kennedy. He's probably thrilled.
And in terms of what's next, you know, that's the title of this series. For Abigail Fisher, I mean, are we going to see her back at the Supreme Court in 3 years? Or is, I mean, what do you think might happen in the lower court and is just ripe to be a return case in a few years?
Well, not by my lights. I think she's going to go back to the lower courts, and it's interesting to guess what might be the outcome given the altered framework which Justice Kennedy demands. I don't think it's certain that she wins in the lower courts. It might perhaps be the case. But, you know, there's a real oddity about that. What do? You go back to Texas, you go back to the Fifth Circuit, you go back to the district court, and have another series of rulings about plans that were in place some years ago. There's no money essentially at stake here. There's not an injunction in terms of the existing operation, I'm guessing. I think the University of Texas is likely changing its admissions program on a fairly regular basis. So I think this will return to the particular factual peccadilloes of Texas and the 10% rule and the University of Texas, and will not return to the United States Supreme Court. I'm guessing that most members of the court wish it had never shown up there in the first place.
Fair enough. And I think I wouldn't be doing my ACS job if I didn't mention there are two vacancies on the Fifth Circuit, so perhaps a different panel will be rendering the decision next time around. So why don't we open it up to questions? If anyone has a question, I believe that you can press star one, and the moderator can correct me if I'm incorrect on that. But go ahead, and let's see if we can open it up to some questions from the field.
Yes, sir, it is star one to ask a question.
Okay, so if you have a question, press star one, and that'll unmute you, and you can ask away.
Like my constitutional law class.
Right. We can start calling on people if need be.
It's hard. I can't see anyone.
We have a question from the line of Ruben Garcia.
Hello? Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, hi. This is Ruben Garcia. I'm a professor at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. And I'd like to ask Jean a little about the public perception of this case and perhaps how it might be shaped or how it already has been shaped as either a victory or a defeat by one side or the other. And I'd like to know if you could address that in the context of the upcoming Schuette case and how you think the message around that, which is a fairly technical constitutional law point, but obviously will be in the public perception really discussed more as another referendum on affirmative action. I wonder if you could address those points.
Well, I think now for me, the leap to the upcoming Michigan case is a complex one. Let me talk first about the reception of this decision. Some people who I respect very highly, I think I saw a piece by Linda Greenhouse to this effect, indicated that there is no real impact from the Fisher case that Justice Kennedy said he was applying law as it existed, and she was taking him at his word. I rarely would disagree with someone as thoughtful and smart as she is, but I think that, in my own view, Justice Kennedy was applying the law as he would have wanted to apply it in Grutter. I think he probably sees Justice O'Connor's deferential application of the strict scrutiny standard in Grutter as a lark, as an exception, which is unacceptable. And so I think that the truth of it is this case turns the applicability of the affirmative action cases, the implementation of them, to Kennedy's view rather than O'Connor's view, and I think that's a pretty large difference. If you think about all the various questions and components which go into an affirmative action program, you know, how you, first of all, maybe more easily, how you define the goal of a diverse student body, how you muster and you measure a critical mass, how you treat one racial category concerning the critical mass. If on all these fronts a university has to get it exactly right, and in the sense that a reviewing federal court would require and that Justice Kennedy would agree with, that including the bureaucratic implementation of these programs, which inevitably involve some exercises of discretion. I think the chances, if Kennedy is serious about what he's demanding, the chances of a real stringent, compelling state interest strict scrutiny review would, you know, a lot of affirmative action programs would fall, at least in some of their particulars, under that regime. So for me, I've been surprised that so many folks who are friends to affirmative action have regarded this as no significant change. Now, as I said, I think it's got a dose of good medicine from both directions, because it does really, I think, embrace the notion of diversity as a compelling state interest in a way that makes it hard to just chuck it out in a couple years. So in part, I think folks have underestimated the extent to which this elevated review will prove difficult for universities, and that there are going to be a lot of these lawsuits, because even though the opponents of affirmative action didn't get exactly what they wanted, they've got more to litigate from, and it's what they do for a living. I don't know why they don't challenge legacy programs if they're so into sort of deciding things by the numbers, but this is what these folks do. And so I think there are going to be a lot of lawsuits, and there'll be a significant number of losses by universities. And so I think that's worrisome. I think that result is probably more worrisome than the broad perception. On the other hand, for those who, like I do, seek to use these programs to effectively and successfully integrate more powerfully public and private higher education, I think the fact that you've had court after court now after, how long has it been since Bakke? I mean, a long, long time, including justices, courts that are replete with Republican majorities, cling to the notion that achieving a diverse student body in higher education is a compelling state interest. And that maybe you can say that Michigan and other constitutional amendments or uses of the initiative process and the like are at war with that notion. That's a pretty strong public rhetoric message to portray. The frank truth of it is the faculties and students, these institutions believe in the import and the necessity of a diverse student body. The students these days are powerfully committed to the notion of a diverse student body. The idea that they would have the opposite seems as weird to them as spending all your time fretting about gay marriage. So I think those are powerful notions which ought to be put in the forefront, anyway, of the public debate.
Any other questions? If you like, just press star 1 to unmute yourself and get in the question queue.
I have a question from the line of Theodore McKee.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead, Judge.
Yeah, this really just goes to the observation you just made, and I share your quandary about why legacy seems to be out there, some kind of a sacred cow that no one wants to take a shot at. But it seems to me that, and I wanted to get your thought about this, it's a much more difficult burden because you can't get strict scrutiny there unless you can somehow show a specific intent to discriminate. Disparate impact doesn't get it for you anymore. And it's hard, if not impossible, to show specific intent, so you're left with a rational basis. And it just seems, I don't know how you would get a handle on what I think, and I agree, is a very perplexing disparate impact that arises from legacy policies, but because of what the court has said about disparate impact not being enough, you have to show specific intent. I just don't know how you would win a case based on a legacy assault.
Judge, it's nice to hear from you. I'm a big admirer.
Thank you.
Let me just say that I think I did a debate with someone about this here a while back, and it's you of course accurately describe the structure of equal protection scrutiny as we have it right now. And I was inquiring of these folks why, you know, I've been involved for maybe 30 years with these outfits who are constantly suing universities, and the truth is they know more about admissions policies across the United States than virtually anyone because they've been engaged in litigation and they've had discovery and Freedom of Information Act requests. So the oddity to me is they know the pervasive use of legacy admissions across the United States. They know it has a bigger impact than these affirmative action cases, these affirmative action programs that they challenge for a living. And they know it's a rank departure from what they say they believe in. But they choose to leave it alone. And that makes you almost think that they think, well, if it's because the facts on these legacy admissions in terms of the radically disproportionate impact between blacks and whites are astonishing. All these numbers of legacy admits are in the high 90s in terms of white applicants and mainly wealthy white applicants. But what they would say when they have these debates is, well, we didn't, you don't have the ready structure of race and strict scrutiny. You've got the impact, as you just rightly outlined, Judge. But what I would say is, well, you know, back when you started all this affirmative action litigation, you didn't have the framework of affirmative action being rigorously subjected necessarily to the compelling state interest test either. You worked to beat the band to make sure that that became the case. So why don't you work that way on legacy admits? We don't know everything about the framers, but we do have a pretty good sense of what they thought about discrimination by bloodline, which is really what this is. It seems to me they were pretty strongly set against that. Like I've said before, that the astonishing nature that we think you can have a constitutional admissions program, which begins with the question, who's your daddy, is pretty overwhelming. So I think we don't know that would be subjected to the rigors of the compelling state interest test, but to say offhand that would be rejected, I don't believe that it would, because it's so impossible to justify. I was the dean of the law school here at the University of North Carolina for a long time. I always imagined this kind of, and I must admit I've worked against legacy admits in these various places, but imagine saying to one of the fathers of one of the kids of the state of North Carolina who wanted to go to this law school but is excluded because of legacy admissions, that, well, yes, sir, your daughter or your son has an equal right to come to the University of North Carolina. It's just that you didn't come here, and so we're going to hold that against you. And he said, well, I'm a taxpayer of the state of North Carolina. And then what a university would say if it was being candid is, well, we think legacy admissions get us money. So we would say to the that daddy, yes, your daughter has the equal right to come here, but somebody purchased it. So you're not going to be able to exercise it. I, you know, it seems to me an honest and open inquiry into legacy admissions would reject it out of hand as discrimination by bloodline, and we wouldn't even need the categorical approach. I know why universities don't object to this. They think they sell themselves for money on it. I don't know why the all the various little shops around the United States who sue challenging racial affirmative action. I don't know why they don't challenge it. You know, the truth of it is, I believe racial affirmative action is constitutional because it serves a very powerful goal of equality. I don't know what the argument in favor of legacy admissions for white people is. It's very hard to come up with any justification for it at all.
Very helpful and thoughtful. Thank you.
If you judge.
We've got time for maybe one or two more questions. If anyone else has one, just press star one, and that'll get you unmuted.
We have no questions at this time.
Okay. Well, if we don't have any more questions, I think we'll wrap this up. Thank you to Jean Nickel for your insightful presentation, and thank you for everyone who dialed in. Be sure to join us on Tuesday, July 30th, for our next edition of the What's Next series, What's Next, American Express and Access to Justice, featuring Arthur Bryant, who's Executive Director at Public Justice. And we hope to see you then, or hear you then, rather.
This concludes today's conference call. You may now disconnect.